Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to the first half of an interview with John Furlong, a naturopathic physician in the Hartford area. We'll be talking about the relationship of science and alternative medicine and the benefits of alternative medicine and naturopathy in particular for brain health and life extension. So don't turn that dial. Today's guest, John Furlong, a naturopathic physician, practices at the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut, and you can find them on the web at cim-pm.com, and they practice things there like acupuncture and homeopathy, massage therapy, and so on. John, what is a naturopath?
Well, these days, it's a blend of many things. It's a blend of the old and a lot of the new. I would say the current education is such that it emphasizes medical biochemistry. That's one way to look at it. We do a lot of work in that area, but it also incorporates a lot of the lessons from the past and a lot of the work from the eclectic physicians back at the turn of the century.
And what were the eclectic physicians? Were they different kinds of sects, medical sects at the time?
They were very strange. They actually were more of the orthodoxy back in the late 1800s and many eclectic medical schools. It was a combination of the herbal medicine at the time, which was really the science of the time, surgery. So it really was the state of the art. And then gradually there was a branching that happened between the more surgical professions or I should say specialties and then the more general medicine eclectic use of botanicals. And then there's a great split after the First World War and particularly after the Second World War.
Would any of them have described themselves as naturopaths or were they or is that a more recent
that term
pulling
was
together?
Probably in that same era. I would say probably in the 40s I believe that term was coined, maybe before, but certainly many people practiced that way. They just didn't use that term per se.
And what kinds of would naturopathy include all uses of herbal medications, all minerals and supplements? Is it dietary therapies? What's the range of things involved?
It's interesting to look at some of the way the laws are written. In Washington State, for example, it was the law there was under the Drugless Healing Act. So that pretty much says it right there. In this day and age, it's largely the practice not involving pharmaceuticals, although certain states do have limited pharmaceutical prescription rights, so there's some variability.
But the
there.
FDA has been more aggressive in terms of regulating which medications naturopaths would like to prescribe, so that seems like a fuzzy boundary too, you know?
It is, and that's certainly a challenge. As more literature comes out, as more unfortunate examples of somebody taking too much of some herb and having problems comes up, the eyes of the regulators are more strongly on that, and that is somewhat of a liability. But in the same token, the states that are licensing naturopathy are tending to have a more liberal view of the scope of practice.
So is Connecticut a relatively conservative state for this?
It is, actually. Mm-hmm. We have one of the more limited laws in the country, and that's, you know, historically been the case. The newer states out in Arizona, Washington, Alaska, those have more of the recently written laws. These Connecticut law was written back in, mid-60s.
What was your inspiration to become a naturopath? I mean, was it that you wanted to be a healer, but you were repelled by allopathic medicine, or you didn't like how long you would have to stay in medical school, or what was it about it, the career?
Well, it sort of manifested itself without my awareness, looking back on it. My dad was a physician, so the sort of doctor mode was familiar to me, and I actually went to undergrad work looking to be a veterinary practitioner. And then decided, I think, at some point in my working with veterinarians that, although I couldn't have maybe expressed it then, that I didn't like the approach that was being taken. It seemed sort of mechanical. And had started to work with a physician at National Institutes of Health on an externship. And he was doing all sorts of interesting research and had a seminar of what he called cross-cultural medicine. So I started going there and getting all sorts of different ideas. And that sort of clicked. And that philosophically was really formed the basis of making that choice.
Now, the National Institutes of Health have had now for 10 years or so an alternative medicine branch. Mm-hmm. It's not terribly well-funded, but it has been giving out money for clinical research mm-hmm. on different kinds of alternative medicine. One of the things I want to talk to you about, as I said before we got on the air, I'm a big supporter of science and mm-hmm. of reason. And there's two kind of faces of alternative medicine. One side says everything that has to do with logocentric rationality in the Western tradition is bad, and we have to get back in touch with the organic blah blah blah. And the other side says people have been experimenting with drugs and herbs and things for thousands and thousands of years. Let's pull on all the accumulated human experience, put it through the clinical testing ringer, and see what comes out on top. And, which side do you come out on? And then what do you think about these efforts to validate the efficacy of alternative medicine with these methods?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. It's going to be put on the spot. I would say I can only speak as my own practice, because I mean, I might have philosophical ideas, and they certainly are the underpinning of how I work with people. But the clinical practice of it has to be, for me anyway, of science is there, and it's a proven method. It's a very useful method, and it has the advantage of being a very powerful placebo. That if one can couch the therapies in a scientific language, then it really helps people understand it. Now, some of that really is science, that the trials have been gone through, the results are tabulated, and it looks pretty clear that what the results are, and that's great. Another part of it is using the experience of science and the history of it and being logical and saying, well, we know the science says this about the liver. We know that this plant has been used for 1,000 years in working with people in the liver. We see in mice that it has this effect. And we're going to make an extrapolation and say we're looking for this effect biochemically or physiologically. We don't know if this is going to work in 100 people, but I think in these circumstances, it's probably going to work for one individual. So it really is a customizing or a fine-tuning of the science and frankly, to some degree, honestly, taking some and leaving some. So it's a potpourri for sure.
What clinical training have you had in terms of naturopathy?
Right. The training as it is now, I graduated back in 85, and it certainly continued to improve over the years. But it's basically a four-year post-grad program. It parallels pretty closely the standard medical school curriculum as far as the hard sciences, anatomy and physiology and biochemistry, that sort of thing. The school I went to out in Seattle was fairly conservative in its willingness to entertain the more esoteric naturopathic practices of historical use. For example, iridology has a strong connection with naturopathy.
The analysis of the iris.
Exactly. To look at the iris and based upon the patterns and accumulations of toxic matter or different things to being able to prescribe or diagnose based upon that. And our administration decided at some point that wasn't going to be part of the curriculum. And so my training is very scientific in origin, but again, taking from the eclectic school, the experience of practitioners like Dr. Bastier, who was trained in surgery, trained in botanical medicine, trained in homeopathy way back in the 20s, and practiced for 50-some years, and using that type of experience in individualized treatment.
Homeopathy, excuse me, homeopathy is kind of an example for me of the line in all of this, because, on the one hand, there's plenty of clinical evidence that something like milk thistle for liver disorders has some kind of clinical efficacy, and there's research on ginkgo biloba for memory, although it's mixed. But there's some research on a lot of different kinds of herbal therapies. But the scientific framework that homeopathy works out of is so alien to all of not just allopathic medicine, but to all of Western science. Mm-hmm. And the notion that these distillates of solution, some of which may not have any more have a molecule of the original substance mm-hmm. in it, could have some kind of clinical effect, much less a clinical effect that's curative or whatever. Even if you do clinical research on that, what do you gain if you try to validate homeopathy when there's no way to link it to everything else we know?
Mm-hmm. That is a huge challenge. And there are a fair number of clinical trials that were basically outcome trials. And that genre is probably where the application of naturopathic or homeopathic remedies or treatments has, that we're able to get a handle on it, is looking at outcome studies. The idea that 15 people or 150 people with some symptom can be given a remedy and see some benefit, there's a number of studies that do show that. The mechanisms involved, they don't even get into that because they're so difficult to explain in any sort of semblance of recognition. It's almost like we can see the result. We don't have the tools or perhaps the perspective to measure the mechanisms. The theoretical physicist and some of those folks would probably understand more about homeopathy than a lot of practitioners out there. That's purported to be the mechanism is a change in the molecules of the carrier substance, not so much the
morphogenetic fields and things like
that's part of it. Yeah. And also that the bond angles of the carrier substance are changed, and therefore there's potential energy stored in there. You know, that's trying to get into the scientific realm. The other part of the reality is there's two aspects to homeopathy that I have come to appreciate. One is that the way the interviews are conducted is extremely unusual. A person gets to sit down, talk about the intricate details of their life, their challenges, their stresses, their conflicts with another individual who asks a number of questions ongoing. Typically, the interviews last an hour and a half. So I ask myself, where else does a person get to explain that much of their reality to another human being who's listening intently?
Well, I can really resonate with that because 15 years ago, I started to have pains in my wrists and arms, and it was a time when people were becoming aware of carpal tunnel. And I went to the handman at the University mm-hmm. of Chicago. He was, you know, he had a graduate student come in and take, quote, my history, which was, he asked me like three questions. And then the handman came in and looked at the history, didn't ask me anything, and gave me a shot of cortisone, said, come back in three, you know, 6 weeks mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. Came back in 6 weeks, gave me another shot of cortisone, came back in 6 weeks, and he was ready to do surgery. And he had never asked me a question about my life. And in the meantime, I'd gone to an acupuncturist who asked me questions for about an hour while before and while working me over.
Uh-huh.
The acupuncture didn't seem to have any effect. Then I went to a massage therapist, again, an hour-long conversation. It may or may not have been useful. And eventually what happened was I sought finally a second opinion inside the hospital, and it was to get some exercises, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. some physical therapy. And there was the physical therapist who had both the clinical efficacy and who gave me the 15-minute, not an hour, right, but a 15-minute right. conversation about, hey, where do you work? How do you sit? What kind right. of work are you doing? What kind of stresses are you under? And so I think this is where this issue of clinical testing goes, is that, you know, it may be that if the thing that's really efficacious is the way that we take a history and the way that we relate to patients, mm-hmm. it would be useful to know that and not to have to spend all this time doing these medications or needles or whatever.
Right. I think that's a key point. In the training that MDs as well as the naturopaths get, it's often stated in more or less these words that if you sit with a patient long enough and you ask the questions, they'll tell you what's wrong with them and why. And yet in the day-to-day practice for probably 90% of the docs out there, that just doesn't happen because of time constraints or HMO constraints or whatever. And so that opportunity for the patient to explain what's going on with them and for the doctor to kind of have the aha experience of, oh, it all kind of boils down to this, or these are the things involved, it doesn't typically happen. Lots of reasons for that, but standard medicine does a lot of things very well, and making sure there's nothing really major going on is one of the things it tends to do pretty well much of the time. The nuances of a person's health or quality of life, not so much the realm of standard medicine as it's practiced day to day.
The research on the use of alternative medicine in this country shows that there's an enormous amount of money going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And physicians have been both alarmed and spurred to ask their patients about more about alternative medicine. Where do you think the trends are? Are physicians becoming more accepting? Like, I have an Indian physician. Mm-hmm. He's an Indian American. But when I first got this physician, I thought, well, I'll talk to him about alternative medicine. So because of my liver problems in the past, I talked to him a little bit about turmeric, which has a history of efficacy with a lot of things, actually, but one with liver. And he was not interested in talking about it at all. You know, he's totally in the allopathic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But so I've always wondered, are physicians becoming? Are they referring people to naturopaths? Where do you see things going?
It is changing. I mean, the work back in it's about 15 years now by Eisenberg up in Boston really was trend setting and broke open a lot of different areas. One of the interesting little tidbits of that, if you look at the original paper, it included amongst this expenditures for alternative complementary medicine, one of the categories was weight loss clinics. Mm-hmm. And so I look at that and say, well, okay, whatever billion number he came up with is probably a good percentage of that is in weight loss clinics because there's a lot of them and they generate a lot of money. So I had to look at some of that. Some of those numbers and say, well, people aren't spending that much money out of pocket for naturopaths.
Yeah, vitamins on there as well.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So a lot of out-of-pocket stuff that really wasn't medicine per se, but it kind of got shoved into that category. But back to the question, I think that things are changing. Most of the medical schools that are really trying to keep up and do things well and have appeal to a lot of bright potential docs are having integrative medicine programs. They are trying to do research. They are getting the grants and the funding from NIH and other places. And the overall awareness is good. The challenge is that the education still lags far behind. So a physician may now ask, well, are you taking any herbs? Well, no. Or well, yes, I'm taking milk thistle. Well, then what do they do? You know, they can go in and look up any pharmacologic interactions. And as I experienced not too long ago, that information is very new and forthcoming, but not adequate. And so there's still a lot of questions. So it ends up, for me, practitioners that's used a lot of this stuff that can hopefully be able to wade through it and say, well, this kind of makes sense or this doesn't, and how we can modify that.
This is Jay Hughes. I'm Change Surfer Radio, and I'm speaking with John Furlong. He's a naturopathic physician, works with the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut. And you can find that center at cim-pm.com. John, the clinical efficacy of these different substances, there have been some evidence that they have negative consequences when they are used with allopathic medicine. So what do you advise your patients when they come to you to make sure to advise their physicians about, you know, what they're taking?
Yeah.
Presumably you
yeah,
generally
that, that's would. A really important point because, I mean, even something as simple as 4 ounces of grapefruit juice a day can have a significant impact on some medications. So that's the level that we're starting to appreciate the effects of natural products on pharmaceuticals. One of the topics we had briefly mentioned before the show was the use of genetic testing. And I think this is one area that is a beautiful blend of what science can offer and also the utility of that science in the sort of real world. My previous position was with a laboratory that was one of the first to come out with a clinically available series of screening tests for genetic polymorphisms. And although, you know, the tests aren't perfect, although they're pretty darn close, it offers a wonderful window on a person's tendency or potential for having negative reactions to pharmaceuticals. That's one of the really useful items that came out of this.
SNP research.
Exactly, SNP yeah. research. And so, you know, every day, literally almost every day, there's new SNPs being discovered and modifications of old information. It's an incredibly rapid expansion of that information. But what we do know is we can test for polymorphisms in the cytochrome system as well as in the hepatic metabolism systems and have some pretty good information that, you know, wow, this person has some SNPs here. They have some differences in their genetic makeup that's probably going to make them more susceptible to drug A, B, or C. Let's maybe start with a lower dose. Or if they're prepping for surgery, let's maybe go a little bit light on the anesthesia to see how they respond before we whack them like everybody else and expect that everything's fine. And I think that's a very fruitful area for that link.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with allopathic medicine has been this one-size-fits-all approach to a lot of different things, and even across genders and ethnic groups, there are a lot of important biological differences. You know, I suppose you're aware that there's a wide variance in the reaction of hypertension to salt intake. I mean, it seems like not all patients, in fact, a minority of patients are actually going to be responsive to salt. So it'd be nice to know ahead of time before patients have to try to turn their lives upside down and at least their dietary habits.
Right. And that's some of the tests that are available. There's at least two SNPs that are strongly related to sensitivity to salt. And again, this is as far as the research has led us so far, and it's always going to take some more twists and turns, but at least it's a starting point, and it's a very reasonable thing to do, especially when there's so many potentials out there, both from a pharmaceutical end as well as the more natural products end, as far as modifying a symptom. It's like, well, let's try to make some choices that make the most sense, that are least likely to create problems. One of the challenges is just how to use that efficiently.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about genetic testing. Is anyone looking at genetic testing specifically for reaction to herbal medications as well, or is it simply the high-end pharmaceuticals that we're going after?
Mostly the high-end pharmaceuticals. The funding for such research is really geared towards, well, two things. Really, it is geared towards preventing iatrogenesis as far as pharmaceuticals. And to their credit, the pharmaceutical industry is being required to have higher amounts of knowledge about what the interactions are, what the metabolism is of drug A, B, or C. So that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm not aware of any particular focus on, well, you know, how do these natural products modify it? It really is almost a moot point because, for example, the liver metabolism, it really makes no difference. The liver has certain systems that it metabolizes, whether it be a drug or an herb, and if those systems are modified by either, and a person has a susceptibility to that for that enzyme system, then it's going to have an influence.
Now, speaking of liver metabolism, one of the areas that the FDA has been particularly aggressive is going after Chinese herbs and medicines, traditional medicines, which are hepatotoxic, which create usually liver disease, and. Do you think that the problem with those kind of medications in general, and Chinese medicine in particular, is that the people who are consuming them here are consuming them in amounts that are inappropriate, or consuming them in ways that they're not, wouldn't be recommended by a traditional physician? Or are there branches of world herbal medicine that really do need to be more carefully looked at, and which are different than the ones that you're practicing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good question. And I think there's some real important things there. One is, as you alluded to, the use of many of the botanicals has evolved from the traditional use, gone into the laboratory where active constituents are discovered and even synthesized and refined in some cases, and then they are used as a drug per se. That is fraught with problems. It just tends to create an imbalanced situation, and it is very different than the original. Original formulae. So that's one issue. And the other issue is human tendency to have the more is better attitude and say, well, you know, I've got this problem and this herb's supposed to be good. And, you know, the first couple of weeks I took it, I felt a little better. So I'm going to keep taking it, or I'm going to take twice as much. And that creates problems down the road. And then the third issue, which
And people probably are more likely to feel that way with an herb than they are with
right.
Prozac. They won't,
exactly.
They won't, say, well, if two Prozac's good for me, five must be better.
Right. There's still that, you know, it's natural, it can't harm you sort of mindset, which is definitely not a great idea. The third part to that is, which again has some a double edge to that, the issue is the need to investigate the actions of the herbs and how, if a person does take something and they have a liver problem, for example, and they were taking some herb, then the assumption is that, this herb causes a liver problem. There's many anecdotal reports about, you know, here's somebody that took this liver pill and this happened, and therefore this herb is dangerous. When the analysis of the herb or the origin of the herb may be somewhat suspect. So it may not be, for example, milk thistle that was actually being taken. It may have been some adulterant or some other herb that was similar. The quality of the product wasn't quite up to par, and there's sort of a blanket
condemnation. We saw that with silicone breast implants. You give silicone breast implants to 500,000 women, and some of them are going to have immune system problems. But if you actually do the clinical research, it turned out there wasn't any relationship between the two.
Right. Yeah, it's a matter of exposure of, you know, one person, maybe not a big deal. And then if the trial's large enough, and the drug trials show this clearly, if the trial's long enough or the experiment is long enough with enough people, there are going to be folks that have an unusual reaction. That doesn't necessarily mean the agent is a bad agent. It just means people are different.
You've been listening to the first half of an interview with naturopathic physician John Furlong, who practices at the Center for Integrative Medicine and Pain Management in Hartford, Connecticut. You can find the center at cim-pm.com. For the second half of the interview, check back next week on Change Surfer Radio or go to changesurfer.com and listen to it online. I'm embarrassed to admit that it's taken this long for me to hop on the latest electronic fad, but Dr. J is finally participating in a blog. Riffing off the title of my forthcoming book from Westview Press, which is coming out spring of 2004, Cyborg Democracy, some left-wing transhumanists and I have started the Cyborg Democracy blog at changesurfer.com. We describe it as, quote, a collaborative blog for democratic transhumanists, nano-socialists, revolutionary singularitarians, non-anthropocentric personhood theorists, radical futurists, leftist extropians, bio-utopians and biopunks, socialist feminist cyborgs, transgenders, body modifiers, basic income advocates, world federalists, agents of the culture and the Cassini division, Viridians and Technogaians, transmitting a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. My collaborators from all over Europe and the U.S. include Dale Carrico, a queer feminist theorist and doctoral student in San Francisco, and a new Better Humans columnist also, Justice DeTaisier, left-wing Haitian-Canadian chair of the Montreal Transhumanist Association, George Dvorsky, progressive chair of the Toronto Transhumanist Association and author of the Sentient Developments blog and Better Humans columns, Robin Green, a Briton and self-described vegan transhumanist socialist, Carl Janiski, a left-wing attorney in Washington, D.C., Ken MacLeod, Scottish socialist and author of many science fiction novels and the honorary vice chair of the World Transhumanist Association, Ramez Nam, former Microsoft engineer turned nanotech entrepreneur and Seattle-based author of the forthcoming book on the transhuman transition, Julio Prisco, a Spanish socialist and author of the Transhumanity web scene and news feed, which can be found at transhumanism.com. At Cyborg Democracy Blog, we intend to cover the political impacts and ramifications of the emerging nanotech, biotech, robotic, and space technologies, all from a left-wing point of view. So check out the blog at changesurfer.com/blogger.html, or just follow the link from changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.